Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, are you Windows 8 curious? Dell's XPS 1, cheap SSD, we got the OCZ Agility 4. Should you use Intel or Asus for overclocking Ivy Bridge? Where are the AMD Trinity desktops? And when will eSATA die? And we've even got active noise cancellation coming to fans. All this and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 172, recorded May 31st, 2012. Are you Windows 8 curious?
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, the show where we try to bring you the biggest, the bestest, and the most important news in computer hardware, and of course, a little bit from the tablets, and if there's a processor inside of them that you can put programs on, even cell phones. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Stroud of PCPer.com. Ryan, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing good, and now that I know that I am on the bestest hardware show in the world, I'm going to step up my game. I'm going to have to improve things a little bit here.
Hopefully I'll get fired so you can have a bestest co-host on the bestest hardware show in the world.
For fun, should we start the bestest hardware show in the world with the newest Windows version to hit the streets? If you care, Windows 8 release preview, what we would have called RC1 back in the day, has hit the streets. You can download the ISO image. There's a link to it off of PCPer's website. And, of course, Microsoft has been blasting it hither and yon. It's interesting that it's Windows 8, and I'll be honest with you, it took me about 3.5 hours to download it, so I am very curious to get this running on my system at home. Have you started it up on anything yet, Ryan?
No, I haven't. I downloaded it this morning while the download fees were exceptionally high. I think if you get it with the installed application, it's like 3.3, 3.4 gigabytes, and I downloaded it from... through my TechNet subscription at like 3.6, 3.7 megabytes per second. So I got pretty good speeds on it. I heard some people complaining this evening that they were getting like 200K a second. So it's going to take a little while for them. I haven't installed this newer version, right? But the changes to it are supposed to be pretty impressive. Now the App Store is open and online. Flash is now embedded in the player. not a big deal if you're installing it on a computer, but if you're installing it on a tablet, that might mean more.
Sorry. If you want to check it out, the Superstar for Windows, Paul Thoreau's site, has the Windows 8 release preview, the ultimate Delta guide. It's here. The Windows 8 release preview arrive is the other big article that's up on the website there. I'll give you an idea of what's going on. The biggest thing is I want to say the new navigation choices. So it's going to be interesting. It's funny, like non-aero interface issues. Where did it go? Don't you love that moment when you're like, there it is. If you look down at the Ultimate Delta Guide up on winsupersite.com, all Windows 8 based PCs that ship with trackpads will include the ability to use gestures on the device's trackpad, giving them a subset of the functionality one would get with a multi-touch screen. He's got a write-up on that on the new trackpad gesture support. And there's an adding features to Windows 8 that lets you upgrade in place to Windows 8 Pro, which hopefully we can all avoid. Oh, wait, you'll need that to get Windows Media Center, which is like my least favorite aspect of Windows 8. There's no Windows Media Center without buying the expensive Pro version.
You can get it for free with this preview, though.
Yeah, but then you'll have to pay for it when you want to get it in real life. There's changes to the start screen, more Metro apps. Metro-style productivity apps actually is going to be interesting to watch, but this is probably more than enough. If you are Windows 8 curious, go ahead and download the release candidate and let us know.
I like that. Are you Windows 8 curious? I'll have to use that. That's
might want to use that for the title. that'll be the one that ends up on Tech Meme or something. E3 next week. Anybody who's excited about video games should be excited next week. E3, rev3.com/games or youtube.com/rev3 games. Actually, the crew from Detoy is going to be down there in force, Tara and Max. We did a preview of that on Techzilla this week. Any particular games that you are super excited about, Ryan?
Let's see. No, not in particular. The whole Skyrim expansion trailer that came out yesterday or today really excited me until I remembered that it's going to come out on the Xbox 360 first before it comes out to the PC. That kind of aggravated me. I think I'm more interested in E3 just to see how much of Unreal Engine 4 there is there. What kind of steps up we see in kind of graphics fidelity and that kind of stuff, and anything that that will enable us to utilize more computing power and that kind of stuff. I'm sure Epic is going to have some pretty intense Unreal Engine 4 demonstrations to show off. Hopefully they won't do it behind closed doors like they did at GDC. It'll be more of a public thing because I definitely want to see some of that working out there. But as far as I know, like, none of the big hardware companies like NVIDIA or AMD are really going to be there in major force. So I don't think there's going to be any big blockbuster PC announcements or anything like that more than what we already know about our upcoming. So should be fun though. I enjoy paying attention and listening. I used to go to E3, but those days are past.
Aww.
Sad. I know. I today is the day I would either have A, left for Computex in Taiwan, or B, started packing to go to E3 over the weekend. So instead, I am doing neither.
They're going to have Negus this week because you're in Dallas.
That's right. Exactly.
Or I should say you're in Austin, actually. Intel, not that we know everybody out there watching, you're probably a super geek. You already know that sand is kind of silicon as the core component of a CTU. But Intel actually has a great video and a PDF. So the video is it's sort of an add-on, an accessory, a side distraction to a PDF they have on basically building 22-nanometer chips and what that's involved. But if you've ever wondered kind of what the process is, how you go from a pile of sand to a CPU, it is a great video, and I highly recommend it. It's actually pretty accurate. It's also been interesting to look at.
I was going to say there's a PDF document included with that as well, like that you link to, that actually goes into a lot more detail, but it's not like overly detailed. It would be it's a very good document if you're interested in it, because the video doesn't have any voiceover work or anything like that. It's pretty much just images. So you might have some parts where you're watching this animation and what in the hell are they even doing right there? What is that green stuff falling from the sky? The PDF document will explain all that. So it's pretty informative stuff if you're interested.
If you're also interested, it's been interesting to look at actually HP, Dell, Lenovo, pretty much all the major PC manufacturers from doing their dog and pony shows in the last few weeks. And one of the items we can talk about is Dell's new attempt at an all-in-one computer, XPS 127. Not a bad-looking machine. It's 27-inch, 2560. The 27 is a 2560 by 1600, excuse me, 2560 by 1440 monitor. Mm-hmm. The XPS 1 is the name of it. I actually really like it. I got hands-on with it at the demo. Up to 16 gigabytes of DDR3, up to a 2 terabyte hard drive, Ivy Bridge i5 or i7, optional DTM 640, up to a 32 gigabyte SSD for Intel SRT. An interesting option. Obviously, if you take a look at it, you know, you've got the sort of sophisticated aesthetic on the XPS line. It's pretty obvious that Dell is gunning, both on the XPS notebooks, and they've got a couple really awesome notebooks coming, but both certainly on the notebook and on that monitor integrated all-in-one. I'm staring at it because it's so pretty and there's a big giant flower in the middle of it. It's kind of funny though, but they're very obviously taking their design cues from Apple for the entire XPS lineup.
Sure. This is almost completely unrelated, but I just wanted to point out the fact that we're talking about 27-inch display made me think. I went to Fry's and I was almost going to buy the 27-inch Apple Thunderbolt display. Because we've got Thunderbolt motherboards and we're in accessories, that kind of stuff, just trying to get a good, robust collection of things to utilize with it. And I didn't realize that the Thunderbolt display will only function with a Thunderbolt connection. You can't plug the Thunderbolt display into like a GTX 680 that has a mini display port output, or a HD 7950 that has mini display port output, even though the connections are identical. The electrical connection will work one way, but not the other. So like you can plug a, if you have a MacBook with a Thunderbolt port on it, you can plug in a mini display port monitor and it will work, but you can't plug this Thunderbolt display into anything except a Thunderbolt connection. And for $1,000, I just could make myself do it. Couldn't do it.
I thought there were like Thunderbolt DVI adapters or Thunderbolt.
You can go the other way. But you can't go this. You can't go backwards.
So I can't go from DVI on my machine to Thunderbolt on the monitor, or I can't go from Thunderbolt on the monitor to DVI on the machine.
Well, see, Thunderbolt on the machine will work out to DVI, yes, because okay. It's mini display port, right? So it's backwards compatible on the machine side, but not on that Apple specific display side, which is kind of annoying. Kind of
isn't there an HDMI input on the 27-inch monitor from Apple?
Mm-mm. No, that's I looked at it. There are only two cables, a Thunderbolt cable and then the MagSafe, which is kind of nice because you can charge your laptop with it. And then it has an array of ports on the back, like Gigabit Ethernet, USB, FireWire, that kind of stuff. But they also haven't released the Windows drivers for that yet. So even if I bought it, you wouldn't be able to use those kind of extra accessories for those devices.
Obviously, time for me to order the Cat Leap.
Yeah, so there you go. Yeah, for $1,000, you can get a non-functioning display. Unless you have,
you can get a display that functions quite well with like two motherboards that aren't shipping yet, I think. And oh yes, Apple's products. If you're interested in tablet rumors, there's leak specs from Dell for a Latitude 10, Windows 8, and Intel Clover Trail powered tablet. Basically, Neowin.net is leaking a slide with what they're calling the Latitude 10 tablet. Intel Atom Z2670 Clover Trail system on a chip. I'm not sure if I'm excited or not excited about that. Excited about the XPS one, not so excited about an Intel Atom powered tablet. But maybe that's because I have not gotten my grubby little paws on a Clover Trail tablet yet.
You know, honestly, neither have I yet. You don't have a lot of confidence, and I know why. I don't think many people have a lot of confidence in it. You know, it's kind of like the next iteration of it. You know, it's CPU, GPU, all-in-one type of thing. We don't really know anything about the specifics of the processor other than that it's a dual core with hyper-threading support, and it has some support for a technology called burst mode, which offers, quote, quick bursts of extra performance when called upon. So it's kind of like Turbo Boost in a kind of roundabout way, but it sounds like it's very specific for, you know, really short periods of time as opposed to the longer periods of time that the desktop and notebook processors can be utilized in. So it's interesting to see. I think at Computex next week, we'll probably see 50 or 100 Windows 8-based tablets kind of discussed and shown off, both running x86 processors and those running ARM processors. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how differentiating they can be from each other when you're talking about a form factor that, if you look at the picture of the Dell Latitude 10 in that news post, pretty much looks like every other tablet out there, right? So how people are going to be able to differentiate other than just price, we'll be interested to see.
There you have it. Should we talk about the latest CPU overclocking record? Yet another act of mayhem involving liquid nitrogen. This time, actually, Gigabyte breaks Ivy Bridge DDR3 overclocking world records. Core i7 3770K running at 7. Actually, I am going to read this story now. 7.03 gigahertz, breaking the previous world record. In addition, he managed to push 4 DIMMs of G-Skill Trident X DDR3 memory to an amazing 3.28 gigahertz. So Gigabyte obviously looking for the mad props and hopefully the market share as a result of the overclocking efforts on their latest, the GA77 Z77X UD5H motherboard. And G-Skill obviously very proud of their
memory. That's impressive. I mean, 7 gigahertz Ivy Bridge, that's about double the normal performance, right? So again, look, I mean, the LN2 stuff is just fun. It's fun to watch. It's fun to talk about, but it's not relevant for what most people are doing, right? in their daily lives. There are very few people that every day wake up and deal with computer technology and liquid nitrogen in a combined environment, I think.
GPU stock checks. We're taking a look at what's going on in availability of GPUs. Obviously, because so many have been so difficult to find. AMD Radeon 7000 series, 7970s, 7950s, 7850s, all seem to be in stock. And the GTX 600 series, the 690 would be almost impossible to find. 680s mm-hmm. and 670s are holding. 670s are selling them for about $400. 680s for $539. And I'm kind of excited that the 7850 is in stock and selling for $250. That's kind of tempting.
It's a good price. The 680, this is the first week that we've done this since release, I think, that we've been able to say that there are GTX 680s actually in stock. Two of them. Two of them yesterday and two of them today. It's kind of like a new record. So that's good. You know, interestingly, I was talking about going to Fry's when we were doing the pre-show stuff, and I went to Fry's yesterday and asked them about the stock of these types of graphics cards, and I asked them how many 690s they had seen since launch. And they told me the answer was two. They had seen exactly two. They sold immediately, but they had seen exactly two of those cards. So they're rare in the wild.
And for $1,000, they should be. Something that probably won't be particularly rare is the entry-level, the low-end Keplers. Computex is when we should actually know whether or not the rumors are true. Is it Kit Guru who's reporting on possible specs for the low-end Keplers?
Yeah, it looks like the Kit Guru article kind of detailed some of the lower-end, kind of the expected ones, a 640. They actually have three different iterations of the 640, entry level, mid level, and top shelf. Looks like they would have 384 CUDA cores, 128-bit memory interface, 1 or 2 gigabyte memory options, and about a 950 megahertz clock speed. That's like the highest end GT 640. You know, I don't know anything. I'm going to guess that the GT 640 is priced somewhere around $60 or $70. You know, it's going to be a sub $100 video card just based on all the other generations of those cards. It's kind of interesting because they've got the 680 and they've got the 670. So they've got the $400 video card and they're going to jump apparently all the way down to sub $100 level. So what they're doing with all those chips that should be selling in that $200 price level is kind of up in the air. I'm pretty curious about GK107 and all that kind of stuff and what SKUs we'll be able to see come out of those chips eventually. So, and there's a funny picture of an NVIDIA rep on that Kit Guru page too that I can't quite grasp why they're...
Is it pretty much the GTX 560 and 560 Ti and then just a giant jump up to the 600 series?
Yeah, so the 570 still exists apparently, and the 570 will apparently continue to exist for a little while. The 580 is going to be gone if it's not already. The 570 exists, so you've got after the 670, you go 570, 560, 550, and then apparently after the 550, you'll hit the GT 640. So, you know, NVIDIA's lineup in the
GPU naming conventions. I was going to say GPU naming conventions still seem to be designed to be as confusing as possible.
Yeah, especially on NVIDIA's low end, it's always been that way because you've got this weird GT 210. G220 kind of mix down there, and then we had the 400 series. They're very lesser known to the enthusiast and to the DIY builder, as opposed to what AMD is more kind of outgoing with their mid range or their super budget parts, their sub $100 parts. So I'm guessing we will see 7500s from AMD coming out in the not too distant future as well.
Interesting. What's going on with AMD's June update?
So this is actually just a call that I had with them today, and they talked about the 7700 series cards. So this is 7750 and 7770, and the short story is they're bumping the default clock speed on those 100 megahertz each. So it used to be 800 and 1 gigahertz, and now it's going to be 900 and 1.1 gigahertz respectively on those cards. And then they are also going to allow their add-in card vendors to overclock frequencies higher than they were before, so that's cool. Also interesting, Dirt Showdown, which is a racing game that came out just this week, actually. Been getting fairly good reviews. Will be available as a pack-in for video cards, even down as low as $109, right? So if you're buying a $109 Radeon HD 7750 that now runs at 10% higher clock speed than it used to, you can get a copy of Dirt Showdown for free, which is, you know, selling on Steam for $49.99. So if it's a game you're even kind of interested in, it definitely incentivizes you to go that route. Remember, they're also, AMD's still giving away Dirt Showdown and Deus Ex and something else for the 7900 series cards as well. So, you know, if AMD appears to have a little bit of a performance deficit or something like that compared to what NVIDIA has out there, they're definitely trying to incentivize people with these software pack-ins that we really haven't seen NVIDIA do at all with Kepler products. So that's cool. The other interesting thing is they're changing their driver model. They used to have a monthly cadence, driver revisions. 12.1 came out in January, 12.3 came out in March, 12.5 came out in May. They're apparently going to stop that now and move to a dynamic catalyst release schedule, which basically means whenever they think they need a new driver, they'll release a new driver. It's kind of a little bit worrisome because one of my thoughts was, are they going to cut back on the resources dedicated to their driver team? They assure me that that's not the case, but that's always something you worry about. Right. It's not a big deal to not do monthly releases. NVIDIA doesn't do monthly releases. They definitely do this kind of random release schedule. Whenever there's a new game coming out, they release a new driver. If they see a big performance swap, they'll do a new driver, right? So I don't think users should be overly worried about this yet, but it's just interesting to see. And you know, I'm hoping that it will lessen some of the confusion that we've had with AMD driver releases over the last 6 months to 12 months with multiple revisions, betas coming out before the full versions in order to meet game matches and all that kind of stuff. So hopefully this will fix some of that.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
Fixing is always good. And it kind of makes sense given the corporate policy where they're like, look, we're not going to chase Intel at the high end. We're going to produce affordable processors. And why do a monthly release if there's not necessarily something worth releasing every single month? I can see where that might actually make the developers' lives a little bit easier. OCZ, pretty funny. They're talking about their game-changing releases at Computex, which we'll find more about next week. Meanwhile, they have released the Agility 4 SSD with the IndieLink's Everest 2 controller, quote, rated to provide 400 megabytes per second reads with up to 85,000 write IOs per second. Unlike its 5-year Vertex 4 brethren, the Agility 4 will be backed by a 3-year warranty. It's interesting, OCZ obviously aggressively doing their best to, or I should say, doing their best to be aggressive in terms of pricing and performance. And this is obviously going to be cheaper and trail the Vertex line slightly and is really close to the $1 per gigabyte range. And of course,
it wouldn't surprise me if this is, it wouldn't surprise me if this is the first SSD to really stay under the $1 per gigabyte price range consistently, not on sale, not whatever. But this is one where we finally see that you can measure it in cents per gigabyte instead of dollars per gigabyte, which would be good.
Well, and really, we're talking about like $250 for a $256 megabyte SSD for like $250. Somebody was just saying they saw it on Amazon for $249. And that's a big deal.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, it's not going to be any performance levels that are better than we've seen before. But in terms of cost per gigabyte, it should be good. So interesting to see. And they always always make a good showing at Computex and at CES. They always have these new products. Hopefully, we'll be able to get our hands on that Thunder display that they had at one point as well. Little external SSD based on Thunderbolt. So now we've got Windows based Thunderbolt devices. We should be ready to start getting that kind of stuff in.
There you have it. What's Matt Smith's got to say in the editorial of the week? The Intel Ivy Bridge Core i5-3527U / Ultrabook platform review, making slower faster. Is Matt not a fan of Ultrabooks?
Are you getting that? Yeah, because he's it's not that he's not a fan. He just he has some qualms with Ultrabooks in that he gets thinner, lighter, smaller machines. That's cool. But every time you shrink the machine, you're also shrinking the space for the battery. And I think most people that maybe had the first generation of Ultrabooks, whether or not that's a MacBook Air or, you know, an Asus ZenBook, something like that, that you just kind of expected it to be like a really long battery life. And it's really kind of not. You know, you're kind of still in that 5 to 6 hour range for most Ultrabooks. And, you know, the reason is because as they make these things smaller, they don't have as much room for batteries. So he's not a fan of that trade-off, I guess, is what I'll say. He would rather have a slightly thicker machine in order to get that battery to give you that 9, 10, 11-hour battery life. But the review of – so the Ivy Bridge Core i5-3427U, this is their ultra-low voltage. It's dual-core part. It's meant for Ultrabooks. And it actually has some pretty – it's a 17-watt part. It actually has really impressive performance just in terms of how it performs compared to the other dual-core offerings out there, the Sandy Bridge ULV parts, how it compares to Trinity and CPU performance. It beats Trinity pretty handily in CPU benchmarks. It falters quite a bit on the GPU side. That was actually something that was kind of a surprise to us. We found that on even though – this CPU supposedly has HD 4000 graphics, and the quad core version has HD 4000 graphics. These are not equal parts. The HD 4000 on the ULV part runs at much lower clock speeds, and as such, it's much slower in the gaming tests than the quad core versions. And whereas I think when we talked about the desktop version, or rather the quad-core version of the notebook part, we talked about how the HD 4000 graphics is actually pretty close to the performance of Trinity in terms of gaming, right? AMD still wins, but it wasn't as big a gap as we thought. Well, with this ULV part, it's definitely back to AMD having a huge advantage in terms of gaming performance compared to that. So, you know, it's definitely an article worth reading. It's too much for us to kind of go over here on the show in very much detail. Battery life improved a little bit. Performance improved a little bit. Pricing really hasn't changed and those types of things. So that's kind of like your general overview of the move from Sandy Bridge Ultrabooks to Ivy Bridge Ultrabooks. Not a huge change here, but I think you'll see again next week at Computex just a mass of these machines coming out. Because I think most people, you know, we saw Ultrabooks, but people really wanted to focus on they really wanted to have time to develop Ultrabooks, so I think they were all kind of waiting for the Ivy Bridge release.
There you have it. From the odd but vaguely cool department, if you were looking for quieter fans, Noctua says they've got a solution for you. I like using the word solution there. It's interesting. They partnered with a company called RotoSub to produce fans with active noise cancellation technology. Now, normally you would think of active noise cancellation like your Bose headphones on the plate. So there's a microphone and they do a counter signal. Basically, they listen to the noise outside the headphones and they play a noise to basically cancel that out. They invert it to cancel it out inside the headphones. So what RotoSub's given them is technology, a very specific fan blade design and a series of what essentially look like stationary fan blades. And quote, they slightly modify how the blades spin using proprietary algorithms and include physical features like a set of stationary fan blades behind the moving set of blades. RotoSub CTO says that they are aiming to achieve 80% more airflow and 120% greater static pressure than the Noctua NF-F12 fan by incorporating the company's ANC technology. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how these end up functioning in the real world. They've got a video up on the linked on the website for PCPer.com, and it's very sophisticated fan design. I always love quieter stuff, and I'm kind of curious to see what the cost on these is, right? Because there's nothing more painful than somebody being like, "We can reduce the sound of your hard drive. It'll only be $400." that's like my worst feeling. You know, like we can do something really cool for you, except you can't afford it. I think it's going to be really interesting to see this. It's you know, basically all these people seem to do is basically act. You know, they found a way to reduce fan noise, and that's pretty much everything that RotoSub does. And it's pretty crazy. If you go to the rotosub.com website, they've got things like gigantic racks of server fans. And it's kind of interesting to think about, you know, the idea that, hey, they could reduce the noise level on the gigantic fan of Doom inside of my projector. I would like that. That's about it for the news section. Oops, sorry.
No, I just agree with you. I lots of use for this if it can actually turn out to be true. As is always the case.
Products for too long. This will be awesome if it's not a gigantic line of marketing fluff.
Right.
You know it's not marketing fluff? Netflix, ladies and gentlemen. Ryan subscribes to Netflix. I subscribe to Netflix. We would like you to subscribe to Netflix. They are the sponsor of this week's episode of This Week in Computer Hardware.
They definitely are. If you don't know about Netflix, I don't know what you're doing listening to an audio podcast or streaming live video, something like that. But Netflix will continue this wonderful process of streaming content to you. They stream TV shows and movies, not technology podcasts yet. Let's say yet. Maybe we're working on a deal with them. You never know. But you can stream TV and TV episodes and movies directly to you no matter where you are, instantly, saving you time, money, and hassle. You can watch it on your PC, on your Mac, on your iPad, on your iPhone, on your TV through a gaming console, through a DVD player, Blu-ray player. Your TV may have Netflix already built into it. There's lots of ways to watch it. Obviously, one of the capabilities is to be able to watch anything wherever you're at, right? So if your wife is watching TV and she's watching a show you don't want to watch, pull out the laptop, turn on Netflix, put on your headphones. You can watch a movie. You can watch TV shows. You can do it on your iPad. You can do it on your phone. You can start watching a movie in one place and finish it in another place. It totally, totally handles that all seamlessly. You can watch as many things as you want, as often as you want. There's no limits to what you can watch in that period. And the best part is we're going to let you try the service out for 30 days completely free. All you have to do to sign up for your trial is go to netflix.com/twit, T-W-I-T. And you go there, you sign up for the free trial. I think you're really going to like the service. I mean, the use cases for it are going to probably exceed what you think. If you don't travel, even if you don't go out of town often or anything like that, if you've got kids, I mean, the kids programming they have on there is amazing, and they can rewatch things over and over and over again. Like I said, if you've got roommates that often hog your TV, this is a great service for a really low price that you can use to kind of give yourself some media entertainment while your electronics may be occupied elsewhere as well. So and best of all, try it out for 30 days, no questions asked. Just sign up and give it a shot. netflix.com/twit is the URL for that, and we thank Netflix for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Thank you, Netflix. In case you didn't know it, we do the second half of the show is viewer questions. You send in your questions about hardware. We do our best to answer them. Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, at twit.tv is the email address. By the way, if you're thinking about building a system, Tech Report and PC Pro are some awesome build guides. Tech Report just updated theirs. We got a link to that up on PCPro.com. And thinking about the overclocking story from earlier in the show, maybe get all excited about at F64's tweet. Basically, he's looking for a motherboard for overclocking. He says, at Ryan Shrout, at Patrick Norton, I know you guys are busy, but would you do an Intel or Asus MOBO for a 3770K overclock build? Thanks. And my immediate knee-jerk response would be, Asus.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm hesitating because Intel has made strides in this market. They've actually done a lot of really cool stuff in terms of the BIOS user interface and their Windows-based overclocking tools. But Asus just does things. They've just been doing it longer. Not that Intel doesn't do it well. Asus is just doing it longer. They have more capability in there. We did a whole collection of videos with a rep from Asus. Kind of, they were showing off a lot of their features of the Z77 motherboard specifically for your Ivy Bridge build. You know, they go over the automatic overclocking capability, the tweaks that they've put in for the really, really hardcore overclockers in their UEFI BIOS and all that kind of stuff. So I would lean towards Asus. I would lean towards Asus. And the best part is, if you get a P8 Z77 motherboard, you have access to the same overclocking capabilities, essentially, software and hardware, at any price range, right? So you don't have to buy the $400 motherboard to get the best overclocking features. There are some that offer better collections of other types of features, but in terms of overclocking, you're going to get about the same support with any of your purchase options there. So I would go that route. So look through their product stack and see which one makes most sense for the other features you want other than overclocking, and know that you'll get a pretty good overclocking experience with it either way. How about we got an email from Joe about Trinity on the desktop. He says, "Hey guys, love the podcast. It's great to have a straight up hardware show on Twit. That's why we do it. I'm just wondering, when can we expect AMD Trinity desktop parts? Any thoughts on clock speeds, and will the graphics portion be any different than the mobile parts? And is there any new features on socket FM2 motherboards, or is it just a socket change?" I don't exactly know when we're going to see desktop parts. And it's a little unfortunate, right? Because we're very interested in what the desktop parts are going to offer. Fundamentally, the technology is the same on the desktop part as it's going to be on the mobile side. Same pile driver based CPU core, same Cayman based architecture. We assume that we will see, I don't know if we'll see more stream processors on the desktop part, if we'll just see higher clock speeds on the GPU portion of the APU. But it will definitely be higher performing than the best Trinity mobile parts. The question will be, of course, it's like how much better will it be? I honestly don't even know. It's not like I have this information and I just can't tell yet. We haven't seen the desktop parts yet. I haven't heard motherboard guys talking about desktop parts. I haven't heard anybody really talking about it yet, which makes me believe that we won't even really see it at Computex. We'll probably see FM2 motherboards at Computex. We'll see those kind of leak out. But I wouldn't expect to see the Trinity desktop, CPUs that you can go buy, and probably till late summer, based on the fact that I haven't heard anything. Not that I've heard any information that that's the case, but that the fact that I haven't heard anything tells me it should probably be at least till then. So, I think it could be a good part. It's not going to catch up with the Ivy Bridge. It's not going to be anything like that. It's going to be similar CPU performance to Lotto with updated graphics. So it'll make a great home theater PC. It'll make like a really good kind of cheap budget gaming machine where you don't have to have discrete graphics or something like that, maybe. But it's not going to be wildly over expectations.
We got an email from Zeke about overclocking tools for the GTX 670. Zeke writes in, "Hey guys, love the show. Thank you for continuing to talk about computers at a time when everyone has moved off to talk about phones. Zeke, we'll do our best to resist the powerful draw of little tiny mobile computing devices. Last month, I gifted myself a new gaming rig to replace the 5-year-old machine I've been using. The i7 3770K with the GTX 670 is blowing my mind from what I've been using. The Core 2 Quad Q6600 with an 8800 GTS. Yeah, I'd say that's a big, hefty jump. But I bought a Galaxy GTX 670, and after scouring the driver disk and the Galaxy website, I can't find an overclocking utility like the EVGA utility I see in all the reviews of both the 670 and 680. Can I simply use the EVGA utility with my Galaxy card? I don't particularly need it now. It plays all the games I play today amazingly, but I'd like to still be using this system 4 years down the road, and I can imagine that, just like the 8800, it will not be the top dog 4 years from now. I'd like to be able to stretch a little more performance out of this card. Zeke." Just the idea of using a GPU for 4 or more years just horrify you, Ryan?
No. It seems I bet that's on the far edge of the upgrade cycle for most PC gamers. But four years is a long time. So he's going from a 8800 GTS. That's old. But that's pretty much in the range, right? Because when NVIDIA does a lot of their demonstrations at public areas like BlizzCon, they realize that the 8800s, the 9800s are still like huge install base for gamers. So what they like to do is they like to demonstrate the differences between the 8800 and like the GTX 580 or 680 or something like that in terms of performance and image quality and that kind of deal. So his question, Galaxy does absolutely have an overclocking utility. It is called Extreme Tuner or something like that. Let me actually, I have this in an email right here. they definitely do have a tool. Now, I'm not going to tell you that it's necessarily as good as the EVGA tool. The EVGA tool kind of, they get the benefit of, they're like the first ones to work with NVIDIA on this kind of stuff. So they have a little bit of an advantage there. But the EVGA Precision X will work pretty well. And it should work with your card. I've used the EVGA utility with my reference cards with a Galaxy card before. The Galaxy utility does work just fine. Nobody really locks people out of their utilities anymore. MSI Afterburner is another good piece of GPU overclocking software that should work with any of them. Although I would consider the closest to reference tool to be EVGA's Precision X. Yeah, it should be. Let me double check here what the name of that is, so you can maybe do a search for that. It is called Extreme Tuner. Yeah, without the first E, of course, just Xtreme Tuner. So, I have a version here that I can't really link out yet. That may be too new, but let me just make sure they have it on there somewhere. Yeah, if you Google Galaxy Extreme Tuner, you'll see a link come up that'll take you to the galaxytech.com website that definitely gives you a place where you can download this software. I would give theirs a shot. If you have any issues, you can install the EVGA one at the same time. You can have them up running, you know, switch back and forth between which one you want to use. I think it's good. Yeah, and actually their version 1.01 adds support for the GTX 680, so it will support the GTX 670 as well. There you go.
Nice. So should we do one more?
Sure.
Or should we wrap it till next week?
Okay. Let's do this next one from Robert. I think that's an easy one.
Robert's got a question about eSATA and its demise. He says, he just read an interesting article that was talking about Thunderbolt coming to PCs. With the proliferation of standards like Thunderbolt and USB 3.0, do you think that eSATA and IEEE 1394 will finally disappear, or will we keep seeing them for years to come? Yes, actually, they will be demising, and we will keep seeing them for years to come, because it's kind of funny, right? Because 1394, you think, like, 1394 should be dead by now. FireWire, but there's a huge number of people that have invested a lot of money in camcorders and video production equipment that are still running FireWire. So people are, if they don't have FireWire natively supported on their computers, they're going to want it added on. They're going to want to figure out a way to add it on with an aftermarket card or some other device. eSATA is interesting because it's essentially an external extension of the bus on your motherboard. And while, you know, I got to say, it is perhaps the worst external peripheral piece of hardware. The physical interface design, the connection,
yeah,
the plug, the eSATA plug is one of the worst. I mean, literally, I swear, in like 25 years of plugging things, wow, 30 years of plugging things in and out of PCs, eSATA is probably the least. It is the least robust connection I've used on a PC. Ever, or a Mac, or any other platform. Osborne K Pro. It's just horrible. That said,
it doesn't have collapsible pins, which is nice.
This is true. Or pins that prefer to collapse than actually connect. I mean, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, PCs went USB or are in the process of going USB 3.0. Apple basically ignored USB 3.0 for Thunderbolt, which was originally going to be optical and then ended up on copper. And then Intel looked around and the only company that seemed to be interested was Apple because they could, hey, lock down their monitors and do other stupid things with it. you know, so 1394 is going to fade slowly. eSATA, I think, is going to be around for a few more years. Or do you think that's generous on my part? Do you think eSATA is going to
be? I think that's generous. I think eSATA was probably the least adopted external connection standard. I see those ports on all kinds of things, but I've never had success with them personally.
It might be because
I don't think I ever remember actually utilizing an accessory with it.
I think it might be because I do so much work with people that produce video for a living, is that for a while it was the only decent connection to like a local...
For performance-wise.
Yeah, for a local RAID, external RAID device for having huge amounts of storage that had some sort of parity protection on it. But yeah, outside of that, nobody really enjoys eSATA. I hate to like kick East out of the curb, but it's just a horrendous piece of hardware design. No disrespect to the engineers that were involved. Because compared to everything else that was available at the time, it was ridiculously fast.
I even have an eSATA thumb drive. I think it was like a 64 gig eSATA thumb drive from OCZ. I can't remember what it was called now. But to make it even more crazy is that only a couple of eSATA ports would power it. Otherwise, it had a USB port on the back that you had a little cable that you would have to plug in at the same time so that it would have enough power to operate on your eSATA port. Seems counterproductive to me.
Yeah. So what do you think? Another year and eSATA is gone? Is eSATA even on the new Z77 boards?
I'm looking at one right now and it's not on there. I would say it's on less than 20% of the motherboards I get in now, right? I think it's a fairly dead connection type. If you get an external NAS box, it might have an eSATA port on it, right? And I think it's for the same reasons you were talking about, for those specific people that utilize it. They've already got their boards, they've got their add-in cards that run eSATA, and they want to make sure their external storage devices support it.
So Thunderbolt's just now appearing on PCs at the very high end. Do you think Thunderbolt's going to be sort of common by holiday time next year? Or do you think USB 3.0 is going to be the sort of external connection of choice for most folks?
You know, I don't know. Because you said holiday of next year, I'd say maybe. But the main issue with Thunderbolt implementation today is that it's really expensive. And I'm not just talking about like the cable, right? So I was playing with this Thunderbolt cable. This is a $50 cable, and it's like the only Thunderbolt cable that exists, right? And it's $50. The chip that you get from Intel to integrate onto your motherboard or into your notebook is $30. That's a huge addition to your bill of materials cost, right? If you're a motherboard vendor, adding $30 is not something that you just kind of do lightly. And that's why we're only seeing Thunderbolt on a couple of motherboards right now, and they're at the very high end of the product stack. And also an interesting addition to this kind of debate is for the latest iteration of Ultrabook design specs from Intel, they're only saying you either have to have USB 3.0 or Thunderbolt. They're not forcing you into Thunderbolt, right? So I'll be curious to see kind of how it happens. I kind of get the feeling that Thunderbolt's going to be fairly successful, but it wouldn't surprise me if it doesn't become as successful because of USB 3.0's proliferation and the cost of Thunderbolt, at least today.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Yep. What's coming up on PC Pro this week, Ryan?
I thought I was going to have it this week. We didn't have it. We have the performance results of that Ramrod PC. So that one that had a 42 gig,
$5,000 gaming PC,
RAM disk, and PCI Express based SSD and hybrid SSDs. So we've got that coming up. I think we have another Ultrabook lined up as well, at least another notebook based on the Ivy Bridge parts coming up for review. And then, so all this coming week between now and next week's This Week in Computer Hardware will be kind of focused on what's going on at Computex, right? So that show starts, I think, Sunday our time. So the news will start trickling out over the weekend for sure. So there'll be a lot of stuff.
On Techzilla, we're going to be focusing on a Windows 8 release candidate, demoing that on the show that comes out on Tuesday. We'll have E3 reports from the folks from the Destructoid show and Rev3 Games and Sony's Android gaming tablet. And I believe we will see Veronica Belmont's new engagement ring. And Veronica apparently got engaged earlier today on the Brooklyn Bridge, just a couple hundred yards from my former dorm room at Pace University. So that was very thrilling for me.
Nice.
Or at least incredibly amusing for me. If you got a question for us, we'd love to hear it. twitch@twit.tv. We love your hardware questions. Keep firing them out. If you think there's something we're missing, email us, twitch@twit.tv. Want to hear your ideas. I can't speak. I have braces, but probably you can type. You can reach us on Twitter at Ryan Shrout and at Patrick Norton. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.